Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
I'm Damon Bolte, host of The Speakeasy. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and bringing a great show to you today from Roberta's, as always. When I am not hosting In the Drink, you can certainly find me at one of our restaurants, Del Anima, Lartuzzi, Le Picho, or the Wine Bar Anfora, which is open till 2 a.m. Monday through Saturday and serves half-price magnums after midnight. Really fun thing to do, where I act as the beverage director for these restaurants in downtown Manhattan. I'm very excited for today's show. We have a guest in the studio from Austria. We have Martin Arndorfer. Welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you.
Good morning. Hello.
We also have Chase Granoff from Indie Wines, who might be chiming in. Just want to let you know that he's here with us. Welcome. Always great to work with you.
Good morning. Thanks.
Welcome back to New York. I feel like I see you every year around this time. You come for the Indies wine tasting. How has your trip been so far to New York?
Very good. Like, I met already some friends, did some very nice tastings yesterday in New York, the day before in Philly. So really enjoy it so far.
Okay, great. And tell us about your year. How do you plan when you are going to travel? Obviously, the indie tasting happens at this point, but how much of your year is spent in the winery versus traveling and promoting? And tell us about that.
At the moment, it's the time where we travel a lot. Like, in the vineyards, there's not a lot to do. Cellar is pretty quiet, too. So we more or less plan our year next to the vineyards and next to the cellar. So when the season starts in the vineyards, we are not traveling anymore. So we stay most of the time in Kamptar.
And tell us about your estate. I think I found out about your wines only at the indie tasting, actually, which we held at Le Picho the last few years, and was immediately drawn to them. I felt like your wines are very individual, very unique, not like what you'd necessarily expect from the Comtal region.
I was in a very lucky situation that my grandfather or grandparents and my parents, they already managed the winery. And so I grew up in the winery and got from my parents quite a lot of freedom to travel and to get experience from outside, from Austria. And then in 2002, I asked my parents that I would like to do my first own vintage, and I would need some grapes too. And then my father said, well, you can choose the vineyards you would like to work with. And then since 2002, I got more and more vineyards from my parents, and they got more and more trust in my ideas. And the idea was since the beginning that we don't want to make some wines which are normal, more or less, so they should gain some interest. And we are in the lucky situation to work in the Kamptar, and which at the moment is really nice because of diversity of soils and also the tension in the climate between the warm Pannonian climate and continental climate. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like, and at the moment we really can't complain.
Before 2002, were your parents making wine under the Arndorfer estate?
And yes.
Under that label. And you said, I'd like to make some of my own. And I said, sure, why not?
Exactly. Okay. So my parents... like, I started a label next to the winery, next to the label from my parents, and I started with two wines, like the Chardonnay Neuburger, Die Leidenschaft, and Zweigel, Die Leidenschaft, and I started, like, with five barrels, and, yeah, that was really nice from my parents that they helped to start, like, a new label or...
At that time, what was the main difference? What was the thing that was unique to you that you wanted to do?
For me, I was looking for more complexity and more individuality in the wine. Like in those years, especially in Austria, there was a lot of wine very fruit-driven, so sometimes even just one-dimensional. And I spent some time in Italy and with a very nice family who was traveling a lot, visiting restaurants and enjoying good wines. And for me, it was very inspiring to drink wine which are not so fruit-driven, which has more texture and more complexity, and at the end also more personality.
See, this must be why I'm so driven to your wines, why I like your wines so much, because of this influence in Italy, and certainly our restaurants have predominantly Italian wines, except for Anfora. Tell us about your experience in Italy. How did you end up there, and how does that influence your wines and your ideas?
Yeah, it was like funny that a friend of, like it was when I was 17 when I did this trip. It was a practical training during school. And I thought it's Italy would be a nice, at the beginning I was more like about the nice life in Italy, like enjoying the life and not being too strict. And when I was there, it was nice.
Good food, relaxing.
Exactly.
3-hour lunches.
Exactly. And then a little rest after lunch. And then when the temperature gets nice again, you go to the vineyard, but not during the heat, during lunchtime. And it was much more I felt like it's much more attention on the vineyard and on the vine. Like, there is a certain sensibility which I was impressed on.
Yeah. And which wineries did you... I know the answer to this. I know that you're with Ronco del Niemitz, which is one of the wineries that I absolutely love. I've visited them with Bobby Stuckey from Frasca, and also Yuli, whose wines we carry at... both of those wines we carry at our restaurant. So, was Ronco del Niemitz first and then Yuli after?
Yes.
Okay.
Like in 2000, I was at Ronco del Niemitz, and then 2001 and 2002, I spent some time with Fabrizio Yuli in Piemont.
Great. And then you have these great experiences and you come back and you say, I want to grow Friulano. No, what did you bring back to, I want to plant Barbera?
No, like it was more... I haven't thought about changing the varieties. Mm-hmm. One thing was that it was a bit more international, like working with Chardonnay, that my father planted some Chardonnay as well. And in the late 80s, like when Chardonnay got really fashion, it was also in Austria. But then I thought I want to do some wine fermenting and aging in barrels to get more lease contacts, more oxygen. And rather doing a single varietal Chardonnay, I thought I would like to blend it with some Neuburger to have also a very old native Austrian variety. Mm-hmm. And yeah, this was the first wine we produced.
And over the years, how have things changed and evolved?
Like I finished the winemaking school in 2002, and after school you got teached all the technology and all the addings you can or you have to do to make a good wine, because if you're not inoculating, you risk a lot about the fermentation, mm-hmm. what we got teached. But after years, we got the experience that if you inoculate, you lose a lot of other flavors from the vineyard. So at the beginning, we even inoculated. And then after the years, like since 2006, all the very important wines from our estate, the Leidenschaft, they're fermented with native yeast. And then since 2014, the whole cellar is with native yeast. And then we reduced a lot, even sulfur. Like 2015 was the first vintage of our rosé, where we bottled it unfiltered and with zero sulfur added. And for us, it was a learning process over years. And I didn't want to, like, I wanted to have the experience before we change everything. Like, it's not because it's, like, trendy, we do mm-hmm. it like this. I want to know that it works before we really do it. But now we know it works beautiful.
And I want to ask you a lot more about your sulfur use. It's a topic that comes up frequently on this program. But the first point that you made was about the winemaking school. And in my world, in the restaurant world, you'll find that 50% of chefs say that culinary school is good and worth going to, and 50% say don't go to culinary school, learn by working in restaurants. Do you think that that winemaking school and enology school is something that is really useful and important, especially if you want to make wines in the way that you do without additives or without many additives?
Yeah, no, I think that the school and the knowledge is very important and also very helpful, because then you know what's happening in the wine if you don't add anything. So you're not gambling, you know the process, what's happening, and then you also can think about the risk, if it is a risk not adding sulfur or if it's not. So I think the decisions are based more comfortable if you know what's happening.
If you know what the risks are. And how old are you? Is this part of high school or is this an after? Is this like college? How old are you when this happens? Because it sounds like you were like 18 and you're studying and you're in Italy as part of this.
Yeah, no, I started the winemaking school when I was 14.
And you were 14?
Yeah. And it was nice that we, I was also... Like the whole week we stayed at the school. I don't know the English word. Like
kind of like a boarding school, you would say.
Boarding winemaker school.
Yeah. So with we all like 14, we stayed the whole week, and of course we had to start tasting as well. And but it was no drinking; it was tasting, of course.
Right. I'm sure. Yeah.
Exactly. And so we started at 14, and then finished with 18 or 19, like 5 years, and. Then I did some other college or university, and this was also not the plan at the beginning, but my wife wanted to study, and she just asked me if I can join her to visit the university.
Yeah.
And when I was there, I thought, well, it looks cool, maybe I should study too, because to have a little bit off, to get away from home,
yes.
And get more inspiration or meeting more people.
Wow. I mean, so as 14-year-old Martin, do you know, like, I want to work in wine for the rest of my life? I want to be a winemaker? Or is it that you grew up in the Comtal and you grew up with your family and that's kind of assumed what you were going to do?
For me, it was the decision more or less was done with 14, but it was pretty comfortable that it started already in the kindergarten. my mother told me that I never wanted to go to the kindergarten. I wanted to go with her to the vineyards. So when she was working in the vineyard, I joined her and I took my little tractor.
Yes.
And I played with the soil in the vineyard, and rather than going to the kindergarten.
That sounds like what I would do actually as well.
Exactly. It was fun. My brother and me had always a lot of free time, and we went to playing on the winery.
I bet it was just like that, such a blast, like being able to run through the rows of the winery as a kid. And
yeah, and then we tried to dig holes. So my father, when he comes with the tractor, he has to stop. But with 5 years, the holes are not really deep. So, but it was
This was the game. All right. All right. On that note, we are going to take a quick break. We'll be back more with Arndorfer Wines and Indie Wineries just after this.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the Executive Director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MoFad Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MoFad Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at mofad.org.
Have you listened to A Taste of the Past? It's a show devoted to connecting our current food world with its storied past. Host and culinary historian Linda Palacio welcomes chefs, scientists, authors, scholars, and revolutionaries into the studio to discuss food culture and history from around the globe.
Have you seen the culture of food change over the past 25, 30 years?
Incredible. It's been incredible.
Linda covers content ranging from the history of black chefs in the White House to behavioral psychology and the evolution of Italian food in America. You can listen to A Taste of the Past anytime on heritageradionetwork.org or on iTunes and Stitcher.
We are back on In the Drink with Indie Wineries and Arndorfer Wines. We have Martin Arndorfer in the studio with us and Chase Granoff from Indie Wineries. Welcome back. Before the break, you were telling us about your childhood and how at 14 years old you started enology school, winemaking school, which blows my mind. After school for winemaking, you went to university. What did you study there?
It was like wine management mm-hmm. and wine marketing. And it was like more the economic part. And more or less one third of all the lessons have been still production as well. But this part was done from Germany. Like we got other people or other teachers, and yeah, it was nice to see also the difference between the schools. Like every school has its own focus or mm-hmm. his own message he wants to give the students.
And how would you characterize the German school versus this Austrian school that you went to? And is it more of the culture of Germany versus Austria, or just the particular school itself?
No, it's like the big difference is that the students on the German schools, they start with 18 or 19. So it's a university for wine. Mm-hmm. And the school I attended in Klosterneuburg is like a
high school.
Is it high school? Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when you start with 14. So the Germans, they are much more, they're going much deeper into the topics because it's university. And this was nice as well to get from 14 to 24.
And so during this time in your 10 years of learning about winemaking and always thinking about that, the time at university, were you still involved with your family's wine? Or how did you kind of manage that?
I worked with my parents since 2000, so I helped my father. And when I started my own label in 2002, I was much more involved in the winery. And during studies, I traveled between the winery and the mm-hmm. university. Like, it was a 1.5 hours drive. And the hard time was always during harvest, because then you can't wait and say, well, do it on the weekend. When the day is right, you harvest, crush, and then it was like working in the winery until 1 o'clock, then driving to the university.
I'm sure at that time you have a good excuse, though, right? That's better than in the States, you say, my dog ate my homework. Right? You can say, like, it was harvest time. Like, I'm sorry I wasn't able to get my assignment on micro-oxygenation done or something like that.
Yeah, we had a beautiful group there. Like, we were people about six. We were a group of six, and we always shared the work. Like, one is doing the whole work and the other is has more time, and then in the other lesson we did the next way around. Like, it was a very good organization between us.
Well, I hope your former professors aren't listening to the show. And tell us, and your wife is also from a winemaking family.
Yeah.
How did you guys meet and how did that happen? Yeah.
We met at the tasting. Like, it was a local tasting in Langenlois. Mm-hmm. Like, the winery from my wife, from Anna, is Weingut Steininger from Langenlois.
A great, yeah, fantastic Austrian winery, yeah.
Yeah, and there was a tasting where they showed the best wines from Langenlois, and Anna was, I think, 14. When she was pouring wine for her parents. And yeah, this was the first get in touch or meeting.
And is she still, I mean, now, you know, your winery, you guys work on it together, right? And so how do you divide the work between the two of you?
Yeah, she's mainly doing the work in the office. Actually, her first job at the moment is being mom.
Like, yes, yeah. Congratulations.
But next to this, she helps a lot with office work. Mm-hmm. And then we do all the decisions in the vineyards and in the cellar together. Like, we do a lot of tastings together. And yeah, it's also that my parents or my father is still always tasting with us, which is, for me, very helpful to have another opinion or impression, because he's working in the business since more than 40 years, and he worked as a négociant in the past, and he tasted a lot of wines. Mm-hmm. Now when we started to make skin contact or skin fermented wines, like more natural, with no sulfur, no filtration, and like orange wines, we tasted with him as well, and for him this was a completely other style of wine. And at the beginning he was a little bit shocked and said, well, oh, that's so different. But when we tasted for hours, then he said, maybe I get used to, or they taste good. And at the end he said, when I don't care about the color, I really like the wine.
Well, I mean, it sounds like he's pretty, like, has a very open mind, I'd say. You know, I think that someone who's been doing it for such a long time would maybe not be as open to you know, young guns coming in and changing things around. But
yeah,
I think you're very lucky with that.
Absolutely, yeah. So that's, yeah, and there was sometimes that there was not a huge support from the parents, like, can I help you or something like this? But they never said no. And this was more or less the most important thing, that I could do new things and new ideas because my parents gave me the possibility. And
so one of the new ideas that you kind of alluded to earlier was kind of scaling back the use of sulfur in your wines. How have your experiments been with this?
We were like... In 2012, we did the first wine without any sulfur. Like, it was a Grüner Veltliner skin fermented. It was an exclusive bottling for Denmark. And we were inspired from Denmark about this style of wine. And then they asked us, well, you should try Encounter with Grüner Veltliner. And I said, well, we can try after tasting a lot of wines in this style. And... like, we never used a lot of sulfur, but we added before bottling. And some of the wines, they never have a free sulfur, so there's not really protected from sulfur. So for us, it was the reason, why do we need to add sulfur when the wine is not protected from sulfur? So we slowly got more and more comfortable not adding sulfur. But this is, I think, just possible when you start to work in the vineyards first. Like, and there are a lot of small details which you have to pay a lot of attention. And to at the end, you can say, well, we don't add sulfur. But this is the last little decision which costs a lot of... But there are a lot of decisions before you have to pay attention. That at the end you can say, well, I'm fine. We need no filtration, no sulfur. And it doesn't taste oxidized.
Right. So, I mean, you have to have extremely high quality fruit to be able to do that, right? But how do you justify, or how do you understand if your fruit is good enough to not be able to add sulfur? If it's going to be stable once you come into the bottle, especially since those wines aren't filtered, right? So If you have an unfiltered wine, but you add sulfur, then it'll be stable. If you don't add sulfur, but you filter it a lot, then it should be pretty stable. But now that you have these particles and potential dormant yeasts in there, how can you be sure that the fruit is good quality enough and the wine will be stable?
And so the age of the vines, mm-hmm. is probably the most important thing. Like, we saw in some years that, even when the roots are more and more deeper in the soil, the vines are less, they get less stress all the year. Like when there's a lack of water, young vines, even if they grow on the best vineyard site or on the best Grand Cru appellation, when they get stressed by water, by the lack of water, you don't taste the great vineyard sites because they just got stressed. And so old vines, and you have to have a diversity or a very lively soil. So, and the crops are pretty low. Like, we have during the season in the vineyards, there are a lot of different herbs and flowers and cover crops, which are all helping to get more microorganisms or bacteria or fungus into the soil, which at the end help the vines mm-hmm. to get nutrients. And like when we understood this system about nature, it was like, wow, why haven't we done this forever? That the plants are the magic parts, that they can convert the highest energy we have on Earth, like the sun, convert it to nutrients. And then to the roots, they give the proteins to the microorganism. And so the microorganism get the energy from the sun, and then they help to get the nutrients to the vines. And it's like the nature is genius.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and so we understood it's the only way how we can work in the vineyards is to cooperate with the nature and not working against, because nature is always stronger.
And the leaves are like solar panels.
Exactly. Yeah.
They absorb the sun and help convert that into energy.
Exactly. And like, this is, yeah, we haven't got teach this in school. Like, this is it's so simple to understand at the end, but yeah, there's a lot of process behind in the plants. But that's the pity sometimes in schools, that they focus too much on like the science mm-hmm. or like the technology.
If you do this, this will be the reaction, as opposed to the whole idea. Why does all this happen?
Yeah, and like it's everything connected. Like, and it starts with the basic, with soil and sun. And then when you put the seed in the soil, they start to grow, and then you have the plant. And yeah, and with a lot of life in the soil, you get much more expression in the grapes from the soil, because the roots are much more connected. So if you don't use herbicide or fertilizer, the vine is much more connected with the soil. And of course, there are other reasons why you use, but these reasons are based on economics. Mm-hmm. They are not based on the quality on wine. But it's a reason, so every winemaker can make his own decisions. Like,
and speaking of every winemaker and other winemakers, what do you feel is going on right now in the Comptoir? How do you feel the current state of affairs is?
In Comptoir, we have some really famous wineries, like with a very long tradition, who made an outstanding job the last 30 years or 25 years to get Comptoir and Grüne Veltliner more and more famous. And at the moment, it's nice that we started a new project or a new cooperation with friends of us, with Alvin and Stephanie Jurcic. We founded a winery called Fuchs und Hase, which means fox and hare. Mm-hmm. And in this winery, we produce just Petillon Naturel. So it was the idea to have some sparkling wine without any additions. And we are both very much interested in producing wine without any addings. And after some traveling in the Loire, we got inspired to make like Petillon Naturel with the Méthode Ancestrale from Kamptar, mm-hmm. or we've been the first even in Austria to do this method.
And in these last few years, have there been has there been more interest in wines that are made? I mean, that's one of the things I love about your wines, that they're so unique and individual, and you have textured whites and Petit Naturel, and even you had Riesling that spent time in some oak, and Grüner Veltliner spent time in some oak. Not that it was oaky, very just beautiful and round and complex wines. Are you finding that other people are starting to question and experiment, or is it still like pretty revolutionary and strange and different?
Yeah, it's more strange and different. Yeah. but that's, on the other hand, because of the tradition from the past. Like, if you tell 30 years the story about tradition, it's good to maybe stay on this. There was a really nice change in the work in the vineyard. Like, organic and biodynamics became more and more a topic. And this a lot of wineries changed to this method or managing the vineyards. But in the cellar, sometimes they're still pretty traditional. Mm-hmm.
I understood. All right, well, I guess that's one of the many reasons I love your wines. And not only do they taste great, but they have such a unique personality, an individual personality that's based on your experience and your passion. I love them. So thank you so much for coming to Into the Drink. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And Chase, thanks so much for always being awesome. And we love indie wineries. We love your whole portfolio of so many great wines. And it's always a pleasure to work with you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you guys for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.